Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Jonah and Ben Play Board Games with Friends. I am Jonah, joined as always by my co-host Ben. Hey, Ben.
Hey, hello, hello.
And we are also joined today by none other than our great friend, Patrick. Welcome back to the show, Patrick.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back again. The most common host. I love it.
That's right. What does it feel like to be the back for a third time?
It's three times as great.
Wow.
I feel honored.
Yeah, really. So tell us about your trip down to OBX.
Yes, Outer Banks, North Carolina. So it's a family vacation we do every year for the past, 20 something years.
Oh, man.
We were renting the same house every year, and it got sold 2 years ago. So now we had to find a different house to rent. But we found one, and it's weird. It was a weird year because we were like social distancing from each other and from everybody on the island. So we each had our own floor. We hung out in like the big family room and wore masks. And then outside, we just went to the beach where nobody is because it's not a very crowded place if you know where to go. And just did a lot of walking, some hiking, tried to play a game of disc golf, which didn't go so well because it was covered in bugs, that place. Oh. It was like a jungle.
Oh, thank you for reminding me. I do need to buy bug spray for the next time I go out disc golfing. Just really quick, not to cut in. Jonah, is there anything you'd like to tell our listeners?
Oh, man, I got a hole-in-one for the first time in my life. It was very exciting.
Congratulations. It was amazing. I was there, too. First time witnessing one in person. It was crazy.
It was great. It was a shot that was way off, that was cutting left way too soon, and then it hit a miracle tree and kept going forwards, and the rest is history.
Nice. I'm pretty sure I literally said, oh, no, as you released the shot.
And then oh yes.
Exactly.
Pretty much that was pretty much exactly what I did. So
it was great. And then Ben also got a new personal best by five strokes, right?
Yeah. Oh, God. I improved by five strokes, which is pretty wild. That's quite the improvement.
You guys are killing it.
Yeah. So we can't wait till you can join again though. So
yeah, I'm going through my two week quarantine from being back in New Jersey, and then we'll go from there.
Awesome. Sorry to interrupt. I know you were saying something before. I just felt like we were on the topic of disc golf and
celebrate these aces. That is much more important than anything I was going to say.
Did you play any socially distanced, or no? Did you play any board games with masks on, moving the pieces with tweezers? That's the best way to play, right?
Yes, that totally is. But no, we did not. I did play a bunch of board games with Candy, my girlfriend, who I'm not distancing from. So we played, we were able to play games in the room and just talk to everybody else while they were hanging out. My family's not really gamers, so it wasn't a big deal.
You and me both, my friend.
Yep.
All right, cool. And Ben, anything fun to report before we hop into the games we played?
Honestly, the most fun thing to report is that I won an auction on eBay for a very sought after Mythic Battles Pantheon expansion that I was never able to get, and it was not reprinted for the second Kickstarter campaign. So that was exciting for me. I'm glad to have finally picked that up. Now there's just one more to go, and then I have everything for that game.
Until the new Kickstarter.
Well, I'm going all in on that immediately, like day one. So, job or no job, that's a game that I'm budgeting for. So,
yeah, if it ever goes south, you could just sell it all.
Yeah, for sure. I guess the only other thing to talk about in terms of games that I played this week, I finally got to play The Gallerist again. I know I played that with the two of you.
Yes.
And I'd like to have a discussion on that at some point, but I don't know if we'd like to have it right now. All right, I you guys know my feelings on this game. I really, really like The Gallerist. Now, The Gallerist is a very rules heavy game. There are a lot of little mechanics to learn up front, but the premise of the game is that you are a proprietor at an art gallery, and you are buying and selling pieces of art by artists that are represented by these tokens on the board. And as you buy and sell their art, the artists become more and more famous, so their art is worth more money throughout the game, and you are trying to earn the most money in order to win the game. And what's neat, at least what I thought was neat the first time around, and I thought it was neat this time around as well, but you can discover artists through the game. So only one of the artists starts out the game being known, and you take an action to discover an artist, at which point you can commission a piece of art from them. And what that means is, no matter how far into the game you are and how expensive their art is, you always buy their art at the original price that their art would be worth when you've discovered them. So a piece of art by them could sell for $18 later in the game, but you could potentially only have to pay $3 to buy a piece of their art. And I think it's just, I think that that bit is like a neat mechanic, because you don't know exactly when you should sell or buy their art. And you might want to ride it out until they might become more famous. And I just think that that plays in really well with the rest of the mechanics in the game.
Right. So there's some speculating going on a little bit with the discovering of artists and buying.
Yeah.
There's also the idea that there are incentives for selling early sometimes, because you have these contracts you're trying to fulfill that you might be needing to get a worker back, or you're trying to complete end game goals, so you need to buy more paintings. So selling one early might be worth it, just to clear your area to be able to have more.
Yeah, because there's some set collection in there as well. So there are four different types of art. I think it's sculptures, paintings, photos, and designs, or
digital or abstract.
Digital.
I wasn't sure.
Yeah, I think it's digital. And end game objectives for you personally are different than other players, but you might need to, for example, you might need to sell two paintings or display in your gallery one digital, one photo, and one sculpture in order to earn points. So there's incentives to buy different types of art and sell different types of art through the game as well. One question I have for you guys, because I know that I mentioned earlier it is rules heavy. What did you think of learning this one versus playing it? Like, did you think that it was just a ton of upfront learning for something that didn't necessarily need all of that? Or do you think, like, the amount of time you had to spend learning this game kind of made sense once you played it? I don't really know how to word that necessarily, but what did you think of, like, trying to learn and then play this game?
I know what you mean. Learning it was a little annoying, but a lot of it has to do with setup, actually. I think there's so much you need to learn in order to set the game up. But once it's set up, there are just a few key concepts that once you wrap your head around, the game earns its complexity, I think. I could probably teach that game myself next time, now that I played it once, you know, looking at the rules, because it's a little complicated, but it's not. It all makes sense once you've played it.
I feel the opposite way. I didn't have any issue learning how to play, and I didn't really have a bad time playing it. But anytime I play a Lacerda game, one word. So this game is designed by Vital Lacerda, and I have played Lisboa by him. And anytime I play a Lacerda game, one word comes to mind, and that's bloat. Every game from him just feels bloated, like there's more going on than necessary. And even after we finished our game, so the fourth player in our game was Nick, who has been on the show before. Nick and I chatted about it for a moment, and he said that he felt like he could get the same feeling out of that game with like 60% of the rules and complexities from it, which is an interesting thought for games. I know David Turksey, who is another designer, he likes to try and find out what the core of a game that he's designing is and really trim the fat until it really is just at its base and best form. And just one more minor thing. So it kind of feels like, funnily enough, the opposite of some splatter designs for me, because it really felt like the rules and complexity were getting in the way of gameplay, which is the opposite of what I look for, which isn't a bad thing. And Nick actually mentioned Founders of Gloomhaven. So there's a game called Founders of Gloomhaven which very frequently is compared to the Great Zimbabwe. And everyone always says it's like a more involved Great Zimbabwe. And Nick and I were talking about this, and Nick is like, why would you want to add anything to that system? Like, the Great Zimbabwe is such a great slimmed down version of everything in that game. And it's quick. It takes an hour and a half, nice and crunchy. And there's nothing excess, nothing there that shouldn't be there, which to me, I feel like Lacerda games tend to have more stuff than needed.
I completely agree. Yeah, I've played Vinios, and I felt that about Vinios before. But for some reason, the Gallerist was more forgiving in my mind, the complexities there. I think because halfway through, it all kind of started to click for me, and I realized that I would be able to play this game better next time and just have a better time because I knew what was going on. Maybe it's a theme thing. Maybe it's just the mechanisms were more interesting, but I think sometimes you need that complexity to keep playing it repeatedly. I mean, you know, it works for splatter games because they're really elegant designs, but not every design has that depth at its simplest. So when you add complexity, it just adds more levers to pull and more options to try and things like that.
Right. Yeah. And it's interesting because anytime I look at a Lacerda game, I always think, that looks awesome, and I really want to play that, and all these mechanisms look really neat and how they work together. But every time I play it, it's just like, okay, why do I have to keep in mind all of these different interlocking puzzles at every step? Which, you know, it's really cool that there is all of that for you to think about, but at a certain point, for me, I just think, okay, maybe we don't need this to matter as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I remembered, like, I knew that Jonah, you had played Lisboa, and Patrick, you had played Vinios. And those are, funny enough, two Lacerda games that I have not yet played. The only Lacerda games I've played so far are The Gallerist and Escape Plan. Now, interestingly enough, I think after playing The Gallerist and hearing your thoughts on these three games specifically, Escape Plan might be, I mean, not that I want to force you into another Lacerda game, but Escape Plan might actually be one that Jonah, in terms of what you've been saying, might actually fit because it is so different than his other designs I've seen.
Except Lisboa again.
Yeah.
Try anything once.
Well, what about Mercado de Lisboa, which looks like a really fun little puzzle game that I'm backing on Kickstarter, but that's another story. but no, Escape Plan is another one by Lacerda, but it's so different in that it doesn't have all of those crazy interlocking mechanisms. It seems way more straightforward, and it's always seemed to be recommended as like the easiest Lacerda game to get into in terms of like the rules and things like that. But I know exactly what you mean in terms of bloat, and I can see it. I guess in my head I just don't mind it, which is you know, some people don't, some people do. But I also own On Mars, which is a Lacerda game, and I have Kanban EV on Kickstarter coming in soon, and both of those I'd like to try, but On Mars is the opposite of Escape Plan, where I've read it's the hardest to get into.
Right.
I tried Kanban. I've heard some good things about Kanban.
Yeah, same. Yeah,
I'm definitely looking forward to that. And I know I've mentioned a couple times now, I'm going to try and take this time off to also learn On Mars, maybe playing like a solo round or two just to understand it, but I'd like to give that a shot at some point too. But I appreciate you guys taking the time to play The Gallerist with me, because you know, I wasn't sure if you guys would like it, and I know I like it, and there's always that moment, and I said that right before this game, where like you hope that the people you're introducing a game you like to will enjoy the game, and even if that's not the case, I'm glad that you guys played with me, and I thought that this game was really good in terms of like this specific time playing. I thought it was a good game.
Yeah, I had a good time.
And Nick absolutely demolished us, so there's that. as listeners of the podcast have come to know, that seems to always happen.
We know Nick is going to be first and you're going to be last, and then we just have to figure out who's going to be second and third.
Was I in last? Did I end up in last? I thought I ended up in third. Wait, let me check the scores. I came in last.
As the only one who's played it before.
Oh my God.
It's okay. Anytime I teach people how to play at Soul Keen, I always lose. So, and I always enjoy it.
The difference is eventually you'll win a game that you teach. I won't. But that's okay. It was a good time, and I would play it again, and I would play other Lacerda games again. But I'm glad you guys joined me, so thank you.
Of course. Anything else you played this week?
Did I mention Zombie Dice? Was that on the last episode?
Yeah, you did last time.
Yeah, no. Then I didn't. Right. No.
Well, we can hear all about what Patrick said.
Time is blending together. Time is truly blending together.
Well, I played a bunch of games, but I'm just going to talk about three of them. First on the list is a quick little roll and write called Twice as Clever. You ever hear of,
yes.
Yeah, Ganshan Clever and the sequel Doppelt So Clever?
Yeah, I always know it in German, but I never really know it in English.
Yeah, Twice as Clever is the English name, and it is a very addicting roll and write game where you have a pool of dice, and you roll the dice, and you choose one of them to use on your little board. And your little board has like five different mini games that give you points, and the color of the die is associated with each game. So you might take a purple die to put on your purple spot, or a green die to put on your green spot, et cetera, et cetera. You do that three times, and then your opponents get to pick one die from what's remaining. So you're trying to limit what they can do and do the best for yourself. But what's really cool about it is each little mini game scores points in a different way, but also triggers little bonuses in different ways. So you may put a die here that will give you a bonus, which allows you to fill in a number on another spot. And it's just very satisfying when you get that chain of events where you pick a die, the perfect die, that triggers something else, which triggers something else, which triggers something else, and suddenly your board starts filling up really fast. It's a very addicting game. If I had the app, I would be on it constantly, but luckily I don't.
So quick question, because you mentioned that you roll the dice and you put them on your board and then your opponents can take the leftover dice.
Yes.
Is this like space-based where it's a pool of like communal dice you're rolling, or do you have your own dice that you're always rolling and then the other players can take from there?
Good question. It's on your turn, you're rolling the communal dice. So you take your turn and everybody watches while you roll the dice once, take a die, roll the remaining again, take a die. But what's interesting is when you take a die out of the pool, every die that is lower gets put to the side, and you can no longer use those.
Oh, so if you roll like a six and then a couple threes and you took the six, all those threes are gone?
Yeah, all those threes are gone, and that will be from what your opponents can choose at the end of the at the end of your turn.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, it's interesting. It's always fun to play. It takes like, 15 minutes. It's really, really good filler
game.
And
it's really clever, right?
Yes, it is very clever. So I played Twice as Clever and really enjoyed it. The other game I played, which is one of my favorites, got to play it twice with Candy, Carson City.
Oh, right.
Carson City is a highly interactive worker placement Western themed game. It's got maybe a 15 minute teach, but could be done in an hour with two players, 2 hours with five players, because it plays up to five. And it's very interesting because you're building out this Western town on this communal map, and all the buildings that you build generate you money, which you can use to buy points. But because it's a Wild West, you could put your workers on someone else's building in order to try to rob it and get half of the money. On the top of the board, there is a worker placement action track. So you can place your workers there to do various actions. But if someone wants to do an action that you're doing, they can put their worker there as well. And then you'll have to fight for that spot. There's a resource that you use to fight, the little gun tokens that you can collect during the game. And you count up your firepower, and you'll pick a tile from your stash of combat tiles, and then whoever wins gets to do the action, and whoever loses gets to get their meeple back to use in later rounds. It's very interactive, very interesting. There's a lot of different ways to get points, a lot of strategies that you can play. One thing it does have that I know Jonah likes is turn order is very important. I know you like that in general.
That's right. I remember when we played it and I really enjoyed it. I'm just looking at my phone now to check the scores because I remember it was a close game.
It was super close.
In February, me, you, Greg, and Paul, and it was 38-36,
35-32.
Yeah.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, it was really close. Yeah, I highly recommend this. It's a lot of mechanics. I won't go into a lot, but I think it's one of my favorites. I will say a funny story about the time we played. I was really beating Candy in this game by the last round. She didn't really have a good opening. And like splatter games, if you don't have a good first round, there's only four rounds in this game. You're kind of out of luck. But I was really winning, and she had one building she didn't place. And she decided to build this long little road out of the center of town to build the building next to my ranch. And ranches give you points for how many empty spaces are around it. So she was basically just building a spite building right next to my little ranch to lose me 1 point, spending all her little road resources to do it. And it was just kind of funny.
That's the best kind of building, a spite building.
I like the concept of fighting over a worker placement spot, like being able to go there, but fighting over it as opposed to fighting over it solely because of turn order. That sounds really neat. I've never played before, but just hearing it, that sounds like a neat concept.
Yeah, it's unique. I really enjoy it. And then the last game I want to talk about is the new one, Pendulum.
Oh, right.
My pre-order copy.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's so Pendulum we talked about last time I was on, I think. It is the new Stonemaier game where it's a fantasy theme. The timeless emperor has been lost and you're competing to take his spot in this weird fantasy city. And you have a unique character that you're employing to do these worker placement actions on the board, collect resources, and turn them into points on these different tracks. The hook of the game is that it has the sand timers, so your actions are simultaneous with everybody. You're just putting workers on the board, taking them off, doing actions, and flipping these timers to determine when you can take your workers back and when you can do an action. It's a very interesting concept. I really loved playing it. It's a lot of fun to play because it's like very thinky for 45 minutes. I've only played a two-player, but very thinky for like 45 minutes, and then the game's done. And yeah, I played it four times so far.
Wow. Did you play it with the real-time element the first time you played it or no?
Yes, we did. We did. We felt pretty comfortable. I watched a lot of rules videos and was eager to try this new concept. That's why I bought it. That's it.
Right.
I didn't want to play a regular worker placement game. So we jumped right in, and the rules were, it's not hard to understand. We had a few little hiccups in our first game, but nothing game breaking. And then we both scored negative points because you have to get your tracks past a certain point on your board. And then if not past that point, you're only going to score your lowest track. So neither of us got our tracks far enough. So we both had to score our lowest track, which is low.
That kind of reminds me of Tigris and Euphrates scoring, right? Where you score the lowest of the different colored cubes that you have.
Yeah, that is exactly how it is. But if you get all your tracks past that point, then you score every track, the total of every track.
Neat.
So you really need to get your tracks past that point to win. So the first game, we didn't. Second game, we did. And then the third game actually maxed out my score with the one of the basic characters. The characters have basic and advanced. The advanced characters a lot more interesting rules. So the last game we played, I tried with an advanced character and also maxed out my score. So it was still very fun to play, but that worries me a little that it feels like you can max it out like that. I mean, I still really enjoyed playing, and it was a really interesting thought process on how I was going to make this new character with weird rules behave the way I wanted it to in order to do that.
Now, no insult meant to Candy or anything here.
Of course.
Is it possible that the maxing out of the score is just because it was a two-player game and she may not have been trying to take actions that you wanted to take, and a four-player game or something where you're actually fighting over spaces might like severely stop, like prevent you from maxing out your score in the future?
It's a good question. I think in the third game, there was some of that because she didn't really have a great score. But in the last game we played, she nearly maxed out her score as well. And it was pretty tight the way we were placing our workers. The two-player side of the map has a lot tighter worker placement. So just naturally, you have to be
okay,
very cognizant of what your opponent is doing in order to play well. But I don't think neither of us are at that point where we are able to look at the opponent and decide, oh, I should go here to block them, even though it doesn't help me as much. But over in the long run, it'll help me more because I'm making them lose points. I'm not at that point yet.
Mm-hmm. Do you foresee it being tricky to play this with four people with four sets of arms moving around the board in real time for 45 minutes?
Definitely. I want to play it with every player count to see how it is. I'm really enjoying it at two, but I would like more interaction, and maybe three or four players would give that, but maybe four or five players would be just be interminable to play with all those arms. I don't know.
Right.
But so far, cautiously optimistic. A little worried that like we could get such high scores so soon, but it's still fun to play. A really different experience.
Awesome. Glad you're enjoying it.
Yeah.
I will try it when the after times start.
Yes.
Yeah, when you don't need to use tweezers and forearms moving in real time.
Yeah, that'd be great. You can use those long trash grabber tools and stand 5 feet away from the board.
Honestly, it reminds me of when we played Seize the Bean, which is a throwback to PAX Unplugged, and they were like, if you can scoop the coffee beans with your offhand, you get like a bonus because you literally need to use a spoon to scoop coffee beans to determine how many you're going to get for like that action. But if you can scoop with your like offhand and balance it back to your board without dropping any, you'll get like a little bonus.
Is that an official rule or just something from the convention?
I don't remember. I thought he said that it was an official rule that like his wife came up with, the designer of the game or something. I don't really remember. And to be honest, the game is so delayed that I'm forgetting like half of it, but
yeah, we'll figure that when it arrives.
Yeah. My pre-order's still in there. So we'll still be able to play it when it comes out, but it's also on Tabletop Simulator. So
we can
give it a shot at some point if we'd like, but yeah, that was just something that sounded similar to using tweezers to move things around the board.
All right. Well, the games that I played this week, my mom is in town right now, so I'm getting some good in-person gaming in with my mom, my wife, and my grandmother. And we played Tichu. What a surprise.
Surprise.
Yeah. So my grandmother, the bridge player, played Tichu with us. Tichu, as we mentioned before, is a trick-taking game. Bridge is the ultimate old-person trick-taking game. Anyway, it was super enjoyable. We played it, I think, two times now. The first time, you know, any trick-taking game, you know, playing it once consists of several rounds of playing it. So it was good to kind of play it and have them see what there is to the game. And I really saw Jessica's eyes light up a little bit as she saw some of the things working in the game. And even in the last game we played, there was a excellent, excellent moment where Jessica saw that her partner, my mom, had won this trick that had a bunch of points in it, but Jessica wanted to go out first because I had called Tichu, which meant I think I'm going to go out first, and I had wagered 100 points that I was going to be the one to go out first. So Jessica said, you know what? I'm going to play a bomb on this trick, and a bomb is four of a kind or a straight flush of five cards or more. So very unlikely that you'll have a bomb in your hand. Anyway, Jessica wanted to punish me for my stupid call of Tichu. So she plays four fours on this trick so she can lead the next one and go out before me. And then after someone plays a bomb, everyone else gets an opportunity to play another one. But it has to be a higher bomb. And it comes to my turn, and I put down four eights, and she was distraught.
Oh, man.
It was great. It was such a highlight of the game. She was so angry. I mean, funnily angry. And yeah, always fun to have crazy moments in card games. So glad that that happened.
Yeah, I'm glad that you get to see people's eyes light up. I like that term. That's one of the greatest joys of teaching and playing games with people is when they start to get it. And you
that's
can see
right.
It.
Yeah, and my grandmother started to see it as well because she has all of these tactics and strategies from playing bridge. Because in bridge, it's really interesting. You know, bridge has the bidding phase and the trick-taking phase. And I think the bidding phase is the dumbest thing in the world because of conventions. But I'll hold that rant for another day that hopefully never arrives. Anyway, the trick-taking phase in bridge is really interesting because whoever's bid is played on, that person plays their hand and their partner's hand, and their partner's hand is put face up on the table. So I think it's really interesting that you play your hand and your partner's hand, and the two opponents know what is in your partner's hand. I think that's a really cool thing about the game. So she was able to bring her, you know, 40 years of bridge experience and to teach you.
Right.
So that was enjoyable. And then the other game that we played was Silver and Gold. This is another favorite of my grandmother's, the flip and write that we have mentioned before. And yeah, it was great. Just played a couple games of that. And it was fun.
That game is also very addicting.
Exactly. It's always great to have these flip and writes and roll and writes that just take 15 minutes or so.
Yeah.
Great after dinner games, you know? This week's game of the week is a game that I own, but it is a game that Patrick has had for, I don't know, 10 months now?
I kind of think of it as my own, really.
Yeah. I was looking at my board game shelf recently when I was rearranging some things, and I was like, oh, this is great. And then I thought, but Patrick still has that game of mine. So yes. Patrick, why don't you tell us what that game is?
That game is Soul, Last Days of a Star. I am right. Very thankful that Jonah introduced this game to me because it has quickly become one of my favorites. And Jonah, knowing that Candy and I liked it, let us have it long time ago during the quarantine so that we could play it until this was lifted. And I still have it. So Soul is a game where the sun is dying sometime in the future, and you play a group of people who are trying to turn your little space structures into what we call momentum, which is the power that's going to bring humanity away from the sun once it explodes. And you're going to be doing that by moving your home-based spaceship around this circular board, building these little structures that will build little spaceships called sundivers, which will create energy, which will turn energy into momentum and do various things like that. It has a lot of cool mechanics, which I'm sure we'll get into, but it's not that long to teach, maybe 10 minutes, and it could play in as little as an hour if you know what you're doing. It's just one of a really interesting game.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we're going to talk about this later with the topic of the week because we're going to be talking about cool themes that get you into a game. It's great because this game comes with a lore book, you know, talking about the story behind the game. You know, obviously this is a fake universe and everything, but it's cool to read about the five different alien races or whatever. And in the game, you're trying to harvest more and more energy from the sun before it explodes. And when it explodes is when the game ends, which is really interesting because you're doing all of these actions, which draws through this deck of cards faster and faster. Mm-hmm. And in this deck of cards, you have some flares. And it's interesting because we talked about push your luck games with you last time we were on here. And I think there is some push your luck in this because you
definitely
have to harvest energy and, you know, score points from it. But doing so quickly will make the game end more quickly, and also the explosion from the flare could harm you because it'll ruin how many energy cubes you have. I think you can only have 13 energy cubes, and the rulebook says that this energy is very unstable. So when there's a solar flare, if you have more than 13 of them, it's going to blow up.
Yes, yes. And that's that's a really interesting mechanic, that pushing for those solar flares, because sometimes you're in the lead and you're like, oh, if I can just get this game to end, I will win. But other people are quickly catching up while you're doing that. There's a lot of interesting games I've seen where that has happened.
Mm-hmm. It's also interesting to me in this game how different it is from many other games that I've played, because everyone starts out with just a mothership that's, you know, orbiting around the outer layer of the sun. You know, first of all, the game board is a circle, which is unique already. Then on this circle, you have different layers of the sun's atmosphere, different orbital layers, maybe is what I should say. And these orbital layers have fewer and fewer spaces the closer to the core of the sun you get. And every turn, you choose one of the four possible action types and you do it. And then your mothership rotates one space clockwise. And it's interesting because if you try and build up some structures in a certain area, you know, your ship is slowly, slowly, slowly floating further and further away from what you have just built. So you have to kind of weigh the decision of how much do I build up over here and how much flexibility do I need to have? So, you know, with the orbital spaces being smaller, or with there being fewer spaces closer to the center, a structure you build in the center is more easily reachable from the opposite side of the sun because there are fewer spaces to get to, go through to get there. So there's a lot to think about with everything in this game.
And what's even more interesting is that every structure you build can be used by every player. So I may build a very valuable energy generating structure, and the way we know it's more valuable is the closer you can build it to the center of the sun, the more powerful it is. So if I build an energy node in the inner layer of the sun, it's going to generate a lot of energy. So by doing that, I have to be very careful thinking, okay, it's very good for me, but it's also very useful for other people to use.
Can you talk about how other people can use it?
Sure. So you have these little sun divers that you're creating out of your mothership. They're just like little fighter ship looking things. And you're going to be using an action to move those around the board, going closer and closer to the sun, and trying to get them in formations to build these structures. Each structure is a different formation you're trying to get them into. But what you're also doing with them is trying to get them next to a building in order to activate it. So when you do the activation action, you can activate every building of a single type that you have a sun diver next to, yours or somebody else's. So if I have a sun diver next to Jonah's energy node, I can activate that and then get all the energy I can from it. But Jonah will also get some energy too. So when someone uses your building, you get a bonus depending how close it is to the sun, but who's ever activating it gets more. So it's a balance of where you place these things and when you want to activate them.
Right. And interestingly enough, the building that you can use to score points, even if you use someone else's, they can still get points out of it. So you also have to try and time when you get points or if you don't care about another person getting points. So the building that lets you score points, if it's in the center circle, the closest to the core, if you get points from it, you can turn 5 energy cubes into 5 points, and then the person who owns it gets the option of turning 3 energy cubes into 3 points. So if I'm going to use Ben's building, and I see that he only has 2 energy cubes right now, he would not be able to get the bonus 3 points because he cannot spend the 3 cubes required. So I can try and time it such that I get all 8 points from this building, even though it's Ben's building, because he was not able to use the 3 cubes for the extra 3 points.
Yeah, and I think I've only played this one time in the before times, but I feel like for me, I had a hard time knowing when to spend energy, when to save energy, and generating energy. But I think the ability to get some energy back or use someone else's building to get energy back was a really neat concept that I'd never really seen as the core of a game before. I don't think, right, in terms of games that I've played. But it was like very much at the center of this game is using other people's buildings and sharing like buildings between players and trying to figure out when to use someone else's building, like you said, when it also will benefit someone else and things like that. And I thought it was an interesting mechanic to throw in as like the center of this whole game. But I think it worked really well for this one. And I'd love to play it again sometime. It just, obviously we can't get together to play it, but.
Right. Yeah. It's really interesting because it's not just these buildings that you are thinking about using someone else's. One of the types of buildings isn't really a building, it's a gate, and that is what lets you get between the layers of the sun. And you're just going to end up using someone else's gates no matter what, because you need to use these to get closer to the center. So anytime you build a gate, you just know that someone else is going to use it, but you get paid an energy cube from the bank when they use it. So you pretty much can't avoid using the other players' infrastructure, which I think is really interesting. You know, in some games where you can use someone else's building, you might not want to use it or you might try and avoid it. But in this, it is just inevitable and you can't win if you don't do it.
And what I also thought was neat about this one and really makes that come into play a bit is if you can strategically place your buildings in such a way, especially the gates, in such a way that it allows people to really quickly maneuver between the layers of the sun, you're going to be getting a lot of use out of your gates from other players and gaining those benefits. So I remember the one time I played, I believe it was a game with Patrick, I think with you and Candy.
Yeah.
And Candy built her gates like straight up down to the core of the earth in a straight line, which is like means you could go from the outer layer directly into the inner layer in like one turn, essentially. Mm-hmm. But I was using her gates constantly because it was so quick to bop between levels, and she was just gaining all of this energy from me using her gates.
Yeah.
That, you know, if you set things up like that, you have people using your gates all game and you've got a constant flow of energy going in. And I thought that was a really cool extra layer of strategy to bring in.
Yeah, it's even possible, and I haven't done this yet, but I think it's possible to win this game without building any structures the way it's designed. If you use other people's properly and they put them in the right spaces that benefit you by accident, you could win this game without building anything. It's very possible.
Mm-hmm. And one thing that we haven't mentioned yet is this deck of cards that you're drawing from that has the solar flares in, there will also be a set number of cards from other suits. So if there are three players, there are three suits of cards in this deck. And each suit corresponds to a bonus action that can be taken. Mm-hmm. And these bonus actions, there's a big deck of probably 30 of them, 30 or 40, I don't know.
Yeah, it's a lot.
I haven't seen this board game in 10 months, but anyway, I think it really adds to the replayability because you're going to get a different combination of bonus actions each time. And not only that, but some of the bonus actions are mean, some of them are nice, some of them are strange, and it can really make each play feel different, which I enjoy.
Yeah, definitely. There's one other thing I'd like to bring up about this game is that the outer layer of the sun doesn't, your buildings, if you build them there, don't really give you much. But if you have a building there and a solar flare comes up, it automatically activates. So there is a cool strategy or like a part of a strategy you can employ by building some buildings on the outer layer and getting them to activate automatically without you having to spend a sun diver to do it.
Right. And there's a guaranteed, well, there are a guaranteed 13 solar flares in the game. The 13th mm-hmm. solar flare ends it, so there are a guaranteed 12 free activations of towers that you can get out early mm-hmm. enough.
Yeah.
The other thing about the solar flares that I really enjoy about this game is every game I have played has had a tense, exciting end. So when you're drawing through this deck, wondering when this 13th flare is going to come out, you know, you might be down by a point and you try this stupid final maneuver to see if you can just end the game with it. You know, one of the things you can do is sacrifice a sun diver by flying them into the center of the sun. And doing so will draw a card. And if the card that's drawn is a solar flare, you get an extra point out of it as well, an extra momentum. So trying this last ditch effort to get a final 2 or 3 points and end the game is always fun. And yeah, game always ends in an exciting fashion.
And I don't remember from my one play, and I don't remember if you said it when you were talking about the solar flares and things during like setup. Do you just mix the solar flares directly into the deck, or is it after a certain point? Because I know a lot of these games that have like, this card ends the game, they're always like, oh, put it, like cut the deck in half, put it in the bottom half of the deck.
Right.
But if I remember correctly, like this one, you just mix them right in, and that means you could pull solar flares on like the first turn.
Yeah,
and stuff.
So that's a really important distinction, because like you mentioned, just so everyone knows, in a game like Pandemic, there are epidemic cards that come out, but they tell you to split the deck into 6 different piles, put one in each, and then shuffle each pile and then stack them on top of each other. That way the epidemic cards are evenly distributed through the deck and it plays more fairly, let's say. But in this, like Ben's saying, you just have these 13 solar flares thrown into the whole deck and shuffled, and you don't know where they are. You know, it could be the top 13 cards.
Right.
One's the worst shuffler in the world. But also, it could be, you know, 4 of these solar flares could be the final 4 cards. And it just always makes it really interesting, because you don't know when the game is going to end, and you just have to try and roll with it.
Speaking of worst shuffler in the world, really quick, because I finally get a chance to throw my brother under the bus for once. He's the worst shuffler I've ever seen in my life. The only style of shuffle that I've ever seen him do is like the deck cut over the top.
Oh, that's the Magic the Gathering shuffle.
In chunks. He does it in chunks. I'm like, you're not even shuffling. You're just moving chunks of cards around.
Oh, man.
And he's like, no, I'm shuffling the cards. I'm like, you're literally not shuffling the cards at all. And he doesn't believe me, but I'm going to take what I can get, because I know he doesn't listen to this. So.
Yeah, your brother's horrible.
He's the worst. Never hang out with my brother. He's terrible. No, I'm kidding. He's great, but he's a terrible shuffler.
So, Patrick, with a lot of your plays of this at 2, how do you think it scales? Because it plays 1 to 5. I have not tried the solo mode. I was going to try it with a quarantine, but just to beat a dead horse, I don't have the game right now. How do you think the game scales?
So we played it a couple times at 2, but we now prefer to only play it at 3 when Ray is around, because we think 2 is a little less interactive. It's still fun to play, but it's just much better when with 3 or more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've played it, I think, at 3, 4, and 5, never at 2. Mm-hmm. And I definitely like it at all player counts. I think at 5, it falls victim to something a lot of board games fall victim to, which is very player dependent, but it can seem like there's a lot of downtime between your turns.
Yes.
But that is, of course, extra prevalent with slow players. So if you have a group that plays quickly and knows the game, it's not going to be bad at 5. But if it's like all new players, maybe avoid it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Do you guys have anything else to say about this game before we move on to the mechanic of the week that blends perfectly with this?
No, just that I'm very glad I own a copy.
Yeah, me too. All right, Patrick, why don't you tell us about the mechanic of the week, which should be pretty obvious from this game.
Yeah, it's actually one of my favorite mechanics in this game, and it's the idea of shared infrastructure. I'm not sure if that's the right term, but it's the idea that...
But it's the term we're using.
Yes. It's the idea that when you build something on a board or a map, that you're not the only person that can use it. Other people can use it and benefit from it in some way. It's a very interactive way of doing a mechanic that you could interact with other people.
Right. It definitely makes you pay attention to what the other people are doing, and you also watch everyone's resources and abilities throughout to know what you can do. So what are some games that have this that you really like, Patrick? I'm hoping the one that I have on here you guys haven't thought of.
Okay, well, I have a whole list. But I'm just going to talk about like a few of the really good ones. So Carson City, I mentioned earlier, is a very good one, because when you build your buildings on this Western town, they generate money for you depending on what's around them. But anybody could claim that money as long as they want to put a worker on your building. And you could try to stop them by putting your own worker on there and dueling for it, but you have to be very aware of what you're placing on the board. If you place a building that generates $75, which is a lot of money in that game, which I placed in a previous play, it's going to get robbed, which it did. Also in that game, you're building neutral houses. As you place buildings, neutral houses come onto the board, and you can place them on the board, and those neutral houses will generate income for various buildings around them. So you may want to put a house in a spot that only you can get to, but it's something you need to think about. Where am I going to put this house so it'll benefit me, but nobody else? So that's one good one. I think of one that a lot of people have played, which does an okay job, Lords of Waterdeep.
Tell us about that one.
I've never played it. But I hear it's like the quintessential worker placement like that you need to play.
It's a solid game, very solid Dungeons and Dragons themed worker placement game, where you are, you know, placing workers on these various action spaces on the board to collect resources to complete quests. And in this game, resources are all the D&D classes: fighters, wizards, priests, thieves. And each quest might need a certain combination of these resources to complete, and the quest will give you points. But one of the action spaces will build buildings on the board, and those buildings are your buildings. So you take a building that's on display, you put it on the board, you put your little marker next to it, and then anybody can use that building, including you, to get the benefit of it. But when someone else does, there's a little secondary benefit that you will get.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is you try to get a valuable building that would be useful for people to use, and then put it out there so that people will use it, giving you the benefit as well.
Yeah, I think after we go through our lists of games, we should definitely talk about what the payoff to the owner of the infrastructure is, because I think some games handle it differently, and we should definitely compare those in a bit. I'm going to mention a game really quickly before you get back to your list. Well, first of all, Soul Last Days of a Star, obviously.
Yes.
And second of all, The Great Zimbabwe, which I don't know if you guys thought about.
I didn't even think about it.
That's once I thought about it, I was like, oh, of course, of course, of course, of course. So in The Great Zimbabwe, you can make some craftsmen to get the resources, and other people can use this craftsman as well. Mm-hmm. And the interesting part to that is that you set the price for this craftsman. If you use your own craftsman, you pay them and you just get that money. And if someone else uses the craftsman, they pay the craftsman and then you get that money. So even if someone goes before you in turn order and uses your craftsman, you still get the benefit of the money that they had to spend to use it. And I think that this game definitely uses it super well, because just like Soul Last Days of a Star, everything that is built is going to have to be shared.
Right.
For me, I've got a list here. One I want to mention really quickly, because I literally just thought of it as we were discussing it earlier, but The Gallerist, kind of, because when you discover an artist, it's now open to anybody, but as the person who owns the commission piece, your benefit is when people buy or sell art from that artist, it's increasing its value for you to use later in the game. Which I think is, I've mentioned already, I think is a cool mechanic. But for me, I had Charterstone, which is one that came to mind.
Oh, that's a very good one. Yeah.
Other players can, while you are incentivized, I don't remember exactly how it works because it was so long ago now. But other players, you're incentivized to use your own little like home section of the island for your own buildings. But when people are placing stickers on the board, if somebody unlocks like a really powerful building, you're able to go over to their island and use their buildings. Patrick, do you remember what the benefit? Because I feel like there was a benefit to the person who owned the building, but I don't.
I think it was building specific. Don't quote me on that, but I think each building had a little specific thing you got when someone used it. I don't remember though. Mm-hmm. It might have just been a coin.
It's right. possible. I'm gonna look it up while you guys are talking about other ones, and I'll come back if I find something. But that was one that I knew you could place a building out, and someone could go to like your section of the island and use your building.
Yes.
Right. All right, Patrick, keep going with your list. I have some other hopefully interesting ones that you guys didn't think of, so I want to hear what you thought of first.
Sure. Scoville, which is another really interesting game if you guys haven't played it yet. Scoville is a farming game where you are growing hot peppers and using those peppers to make hot sauces and, you know, getting various points in various ways. And the main board is this sort of grid of peppers, and you're required to plant a pepper every turn. And when you put a pepper on the board, anybody could harvest that pepper. And the way you harvest in this game is you have a little farmer that walks around the board. And if he walks, when he walks between he or she, when the farmer
when
walks
they between, walk between,
when they walk between two peppers, that player will get the crossbreed of those two peppers. So there's various different colored peppers, and they get more and more valuable. And when you place a valuable pepper on the board in order to create an even more valuable pepper with its neighbor, you have to be very careful because anybody could walk their farmer in between those peppers.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's a very tight game. Also very tight on turn order, Jonah.
Ooh,
because order is very important in that one, yeah.
Now, I just have a general question about this game. Have you ever participated in the real-life pepper-eating version of this that Paul puts on when they do have their extra life marathon gaming session thing?
I have. I did it twice, and it's a lot of fun. Paul does a good job with his extra life event. I don't know if that will ever happen again, but it was a fun time while it lasted.
It's a good time.
So the real life version, there's he would create six batches of hot wings of various Scoville ratings, from mild to very, very painfully hot. And at certain points in the game, we'd eat an increasingly hot wing until the game ended and we ate the hottest one.
Man, I love it. That is right up my alley. I'm a big spice eater, so.
Yeah, I'm not, so I've always said no, but it's always fun to like hear people going like, whoo, this is hot, like while you're playing another game. It's always a fun time.
It's great. Shout out to Paul. That was a lot of fun.
Awesome.
So another game that does this, Eco's First Continent, which I've talked about previously on the game, you're creating this shared map of terrain tiles and putting animals on them and various things, and in order to create combinations that will score you points. But anybody could use the map. Anybody could use the animal you just placed to get themselves points, depending on what cards they have. So you have to be very mindful. If you see someone employing a strategy where they get a lot of points for giant water formations, for example, you might think twice placing that water tile on a certain spot.
Cool. Mm-hmm. Can I mention one and you can tell me if it is or is not correct? So I wrote down, I know one that I wrote down is definitely wrong and I'll mention it later, but Pax Pamir.
Hey, I had it on my list.
I thought it was a sleeper hit. Go on.
Yeah, I think it fits the bill, although it's a weird one. It's a weird one.
Right, so in Pax Pamir, you're playing as either an Afghan, a Russian, or a British person, and you're an Afghan tribe that is either loyal to the Afghans, the British, or the Russians, and your loyalty can change throughout the game, which means I can build a British road and a British army, and then later, or even right now, when Patrick is playing as a British loyal Afghan, he can move that army and he can build a new road. Mm-hmm. So it just barely qualifies, because while the other players can use the same infrastructure, it is also their infrastructure when they can use it. So,
yeah.
Asterisk.
Speaking of asterisk, I might as well add one to Charterstone now, because I did find the answer. It's shared in that the infrastructure of Charterstone is shared in that if you build a strategically important building in your section of the map, it kind of works where when you place a worker down, if you place it where there's an occupied building, you bump that worker back to the person's supply. So the benefit is if you put a building out that a lot of people are going to want and you build it in your area of the map, more people will be likely to bump your worker back to your hand instead of you having to like spend a turn taking your worker back. But nothing in terms of gaining a benefit in terms of like a resource or monetary benefit. So let's put an asterisk on Charterstone as well.
All right. Another one that I wanted to mention very quickly is 18XX. This is barely on this list, but since you can lay a train track onto the board and then other people can use that track to make money, I think it counts. And that's it. Yeah, so definitely. Go on, Patrick.
All right. I have a few more. Jonah's favorite, Food Chain Magnet.
That's right. And which implementation are you talking about?
Well, the expansion has some, but I think the base game does as well, because the base game, you can build houses that, you know, they would benefit you, theoretically, where you place this house, or expand a house to a house with a garden, but they're anybody's that they could use.
Right.
Yeah.
I think Ben wants to say something.
That brings me to bus. I didn't even think of bus.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're building buildings. Wow, there are a lot of games with this.
Oh yeah, bus. You're placing the people down on the board.
It's pretty much every splatter game if you think about it. Like Indonesia, you can make the new bus route, not the bus routes, the boat routes.
Yes.
Anyway, yes.
Yeah,
bus. I mean, not bus. Indonesia shared infrastructure. You could steal somebody's company out from under them.
Yeah, it's sharing.
Sharing is caring.
Yep. Food Chain also has the roads in the expansion where you can start building roads to make other connections, and anybody can use those roads and not just yours.
Right. Yeah. I think also just the main meat of the game, which is the demand, you know, you can create this demand, but other people can fulfill it. And that's kind of a shared infrastructure because it's how you actually make money.
Yeah. I have a few others on my list here. Everdell. I know you two haven't played Everdell yet, but you could add cards to your tableau that literally have an open sign on them, which means someone else can come in and place and activate that card in your tableau. I don't think that game does it well. I don't want to talk about games that just do it well. This one I don't think does it well because you can have like 15 cards in your tableau and other players have 15 cards, and you know, you can't be looking around the board just to like read everybody's cards.
Right.
To figure out if you want to place a worker there or not. You have your own thing going on with your 15 cards you're looking at. So that's one that I was not too happy with. I'll throw out Scythe as one. In Scythe, you place resources that you generate on the board. So they are yours as long as you control them. But you know, if you make a nice juicy spot of resources, someone's going to come in with their mechs and steal those resources, potentially.
Right. And this actually reminds me, I really don't want to mention Splatter every 5 seconds, but Roads and Boats apparently does this. We haven't played Roads and Boats, but apparently in Roads and Boats, no one owns the resources. It's just, can you like carry them somewhere else? So in Scythe, I think you do kind of own them because you can have them in your hex and guard them.
Yes.
But you have to get in a battle to steal someone else's resources.
Right. And the other one that is kind of, I'm not sure, Tokyo Metro, in a way, because Tokyo Metro, you're activating these trains that everybody can use. And if you invest in a train to make it move a whole bunch of spaces, it could be benefiting not just you, but a lot of people in the process.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, I thought of Tokyo Metro as well, which made me think of 18XX games, which made me think any game with a train in it is going to have the shared infrastructure.
Right.
Yeah. Speaking of Tokyo Metro, I did just today get a Kickstarter update for the expansions, and it looks quite good. The Fireburn money looks really nice. So
I'm excited for that.
Yeah.
All right. Are you ready for my this doesn't count honorable mention?
Yes, sure. Please.
This is one with shared infrastructure where no one builds the infrastructure. It just already exists in the game. I will take one guess from each of you.
Isn't this any worker placement that has pre-built buildings?
They're not buildings. They're animals.
They're animals. Oh, camel cup? Camel up?
Oh, yes.
Bingo. Yes.
Yep.
In this magnificent, magnificent game, you are so betting on camels that are racing around a track. And these camels can stack on top of each other, which means when the lower camel moves, all camels on top of it also move. And no one is a camel, so it is a shared infrastructure.
That is the biggest thing that you need to say to anybody who is trying to play this game. You are not the camels.
That's right.
Repeat after me.
All right, so which games do you guys think do this well, and which games, maybe besides Everdell, don't do this well?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to stick with the first few I mentioned. Seoul, Carson City, Scoville, I think, do it really well, and it's a core part of the game. And there are a few games that do it well, but it's not core, like Ecos and Food Chain and things like that.
I don't think Scythe does it well, because I don't think that Scythe is meant to be on this list. It was on my list as well, but the only way that you get these resources that somebody produced is to go in and attack that person.
Right.
And there's such a negative hit to your popularity for attacking people, and most likely they will have workers there as opposed to just mechs if there's resources. So it's like, it's not meant for that to be like constantly used. I've played one game, I think, where somebody stole resources from another player.
Right.
Yeah, I think Seoul is definitely kind of the gold standard for this, just because every single building is going to be used by other people throughout the game.
Yeah.
And then I want to try Scoville still, so I'll try that and form an opinion. And then the game that I mentioned, Great Zimbabwe, I think does it really well, because you like really care about the other craftsmen. So you may have noticed that we have not had a Ben's Backings segment this week, and that is because we are trying something new. We have a rotating topic of the week, and this week's topic is games with a neat theme that draw you in. So we are likely to have some different opinions on what is a neat theme. So Ben, what do you think is a neat theme, and what game did it draw you into?
So for me, interestingly enough, the first game that drew me in from its theme was actually Scythe. That was the first big board game purchase I made. Literally the first one. I discovered Watch It Played back when I was buying Scythe, because I watched this rules video like 9 times at least before I made my decision to buy this game. Far cry from what I do when I research games now. But I don't know if it was necessarily the theme as much as like just the general look of the game, but the more I looked into the theme, the cooler it got to me. Like, it's an alternate 1920s universe where there's like mechs walking around, but people are like so used to these mechs that they're like literally just like working the farm while mechs are like strolling nearby. And it had like this really cool, like grounded sci-fi theme and look to it that I really, really liked. And what's neat is it's literally a world that's built by the artist, Jakub Rozalski is his name. And he like built this world, which is called, I think, 1920s plus Europa or something. And Scythe is just is the only licensed board game to use this universe. But it's not the only thing that's allowed to use this universe. There's a real-time strategy video game that just released called Iron Harvest, which is in the 1920s plus universe. And it's got the same factions as Scythe. It's got, you know, the same mechs and everything. And it's pretty neat, and I definitely want to take a look at that as well. But that was a theme that drew me in.
There is a slight thing we should mention, and that was the issue with the art in this game.
Yes.
Is plagiarized the right word for art, or is it just stolen?
I think so, but the thing is, I don't really know the full like outcome of it. But basically, what happened was people kind of put together a whole portfolio, and you could look this up if you'd like to. But people put together like this whole portfolio of art from Jakub Brzezowski that kind of showed that it very, very, very much looked like he was tracing
over his other art
from other people, and like then taking pieces of that traced art and dropping it in to make his world. Now, what's interesting is in his rebuttal to all of this, he posted oil paintings that he did that look exactly like his art. So he clearly is talented enough to not have to do this, but there are also clear points at which he definitely traced somebody's art and brought it into the game. And I don't know if we can really bring that up against Scythe as a whole, because Stonemaier had nothing. Like, what is Stonemaier supposed to do? They just took the art from the artist.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that came out, I would say probably a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago now. But I don't know what the actual outcome of it was, like if anything happened, but game's still going strong, so I guess nothing, but
right.
Yeah, definitely something to mention.
Patrick, any neat themes that you'd like to mention? I mean, we're going to bounce around because I'm sure we all have a big list.
Yeah, Tavarua is the first one that jumped to mind. Tavarua is a game about surfing from Cody Miller, the creator of Shea. And it really feels like you are in a surfing tournament, although I'd never been in a surfing tournament or really been surfing for that matter. But it has this really cool idea where there's these waves flowing towards you on this board. And on your turn, you're just, you know, moving your surfer out or in or trying to pick up these waves. And everyone else is doing it at the same time. And you're just trying to score points by riding these waves in and doing cool tricks. And it really feels cool. And the theme and mechanics just work really well together with these wave dice that keep coming towards you. It's a lot of fun.
That actually sounds really, really neat.
Yeah.
That reminds me, barely, only because of water, of a game called Petrichor, called David Turtsy. I've never played the game, but it's a game where you are all clouds and you are growing as clouds and watering things. I guess raining on things is the scientifically correct term.
Yes, it's like there's a whole world of the clouds and humans are their little plants and they're watering yeah. everybody.
Yes, that's exactly it. Anyway, I've never played it, but it looks really neat.
It's a neat theme for sure.
Yeah.
Jonah, what about you?
On my list, I put Soul Last Days of a Star because that's really neat to have different aliens harvesting a sun and then it blows up. So that's cool. I have a strange one on here. I have Dice Fishing Roll and Catch on here. Only because...
Great game, though. I mean, yeah, honestly.
It's a super fun push your luck game. Maybe it's a pull your luck game because you're trying to do stuff with as few dice as possible.
You're also pulling in fish. Good one.
Exactly. Anyway, it's a game about fishing, but the way you fish is a card will come out with a type of fish on it, and it will have a number on it and possibly some qualifications, and you have to try and roll your dice to equal that number. So if you choose fewer dice and you get it, then you will take the fish, and everyone has, I think, six-sided dice, one 10-sided die, and one 20-sided die. So if you want to use your d20 to roll a 10, and someone else wants to use 2d6 to roll a 10, you might beat them to it. And I think it's a really neat idea to have fishing, which of course is a very random activity, I think, be distilled down into a dice game. So that was a neat theme that drew me in because it's wacky and fun. All right, Patrick, your turn.
All right, so I'll throw in another little game called Lovelace and Babbage.
Right. Oh, that's a brain burner.
It is definitely a brain burner, and the theme is you are computer programmers back in the dawn of the computer programming era before they even really had computers, based on the two famous titular people who were sort of forerunners of the computer movement. And on your, what you're trying to do is there's this little board with these mathematical things on it, plus 12, minus 5, times 3, et cetera, et cetera. And you have a target number you're trying to get to and a starting number that you have. And you're trying to use those multipliers and things in order to get from your starting number to the final number via these programming steps that you're writing on your sheet.
And have you seen the show Countdown?
I have not, no.
Because there is a show that is this, or this game is definitely based on the show Countdown.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's cool. Yeah, it's fun. It's basically fast math, the game, but the theme comes through because it's got this really cool little sheet that you're kind of programming your instructions on. So each instruction is on a grid with letters and numbers at the top. So if you want to do the third one on the top, you have to put A3. If you want to do the fifth one down, second in, you put E2. So that's how you're programming your thing. You're writing these commands on your sheet.
You almost confused yourself there, Patrick.
I know, I did.
Letter.
So yeah, fast math, the game. Highly recommended if that's your thing. Lovelace and Babbage.
I'll mention a game that I know is on Ben's list. It is by Mind Clash Games, and it is called Tricarion.
Damn it, that was my next.
Stealing it from Ben.
All right, Ben, tell us about Tricarion really quickly.
Tricarion, one of my favorite games, which, by the way, I think at some point we need to talk about this really cool game comparison thing that we did, but that's a whole nother discussion. Tricarion is a game where you are magicians, and you are playing as magicians in this city, and you are trying to take over for Dalgard, the resident magician who has up and left. And you're trying to essentially prove that you are the most famous magician that still remains in this city and take over for Dalgard. And what's neat is it's a worker placement game that's super puzzly, but you have different workers that have different point values to spend on actions, but you have a main magician figure or pawn, I guess you could call it, that you is the only one that you can actually perform tricks with. So you actually have to build your tricks, go to the theater, perform these tricks in front of an audience, and depending on whether or not you were the headliner for the show, will affect things like the score that you get for that particular trick. And I've always liked magic. I can't do any magic, and I know that magic isn't, I mean, really real, but it's still
Are you sure, Ben? It sounds like you're not sure.
All right, okay. Some things don't seem like it's possible if it's not magic. But no, this is one of those games that I've always loved magic, and just seeing, like, this was the first magic board game I saw that was like about magicians, and I love it, and the theme absolutely drew me in.
Yeah, it's super cool. And Mind Clash Games, you know, every game they have is definitely the theme draws you in game. So, you know, Cerebria, I think, is a super neat game. I think we've mentioned it before. It's basically Inside Out, the movie, the board game.
Yeah.
So it's an area control game where you are playing in teams as either Gloom or Bliss, fighting for control of the human mind. So I think it's really neat to have a game about emotions fighting for balance or imbalance, I guess, in the human brain. And then, like we mentioned before, Anachrony, the worker placement game with time travel and exosuits. Sure. Super cool. And I think it's important to point out or to note that while a cool theme can draw you in, the art is what really sells the deal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's definitely true in Cerebria and Anachrony and Tricarion.
Yeah, I think Mind Clash is just a company that you could mention for me, and that would work. I guess since my game was taken, I'll move on to the next one.
I
don't think I could take your next one. This is probably the number two game on my list in terms of theme behind Tricarion. Can either of you guess what it is? Because I think that you probably can.
Hansa Teutonica.
Oh, for sure. I own it. I'll tell you that much. I own it.
Is it Shia?
Is it Batman Gotham City Chronicles?
Oh, both of those are on my list, but it is not this next one. Kingdom Death Monster.
Oh, yes, of course.
That is very true.
This game solely drew me in on theme alone. Like, there's no part of me that would have ever went online and been like, board games called Kingdom Death Monster if I didn't first see, like, the theme and the art. This one drew me in 100% specifically from the theme.
Right.
And luckily for myself, at least, the gameplay matches up, and I really enjoy how the theme comes through in the gameplay as well, so...
Oozing theme from every orifice, as they say.
Oh, jeez.
I mean, in this game, literally. Very true in that game. Yep.
Well, I'm going to hit on some I think we already talked about. Scoville, I think, is a great theme. It's a lot of fun, especially if you're like spice.
I've also never seen a game with a theme literally about farming peppers. So
yeah,
farming peppers, everything else. Yes,
yeah.
Making hot sauces. The hot sauces all have cool names. It really feels cool playing that one. And I'll just throw out a few quick ones. Hako Ona, the Japanese ghost hidden movement game.
Okay, sweet. Sounds cool.
Oh, you just reminded me of another one that I'll talk about in a moment.
It's pretty cool. One person plays this Japanese ghost in this haunted house, and the other people are trying to escape. But it really has just everything about it makes the theme come alive, especially when players have to close their eyes while the ghost is shifting things around the board, like that. It's not a great game, but it definitely has a good theme.
Mention one really quickly because it's very similar to that?
Mm-hmm.
I haven't played this. I want to play it. It's from Japan. It is Psychic Pizza Deliverers Go to the Ghost Town. And let me just read a minor blurb.
It literally sounds like an anime title.
Yeah, right.
In this game, players are divided into the pizza delivery professionals and a mayor who controls the ghosts and builds the town. The pizza delivery professionals have to find a pizza and deliver it to the right house in town, all while avoiding ghosts, barriers, and mystic teleportation runes. Sounds awesome. That's all. Continue, Patrick.
I like how they're specifying that you're not like a pizza delivery amateur. You're a professional.
Yeah.
Like you're not just some scrub that delivers pizza. You're a pro.
You've been doing this for years. That's cool. I was saying Captain Sonar, I think, is a cool theme. Submarines fighting each other. Team versus team combat, but it just really feels like you're in this tense situation when you play it against another team, you know, doing your own little thing on your little board, depending on what your role is. It just feels tense, like it should.
Right. Yeah. It's basically real-time Battleship, which is what I say every time. And it's just awesome.
Yeah. And a few others I just don't want to spend a lot of time on. Wingspan, I think, is a cool theme for worker placement, engine building game. Ladies and Gentlemen.
What is the theme of Wingspan, Patrick?
Oh, that's true. It's you are collecting birds. You are bird watching, collecting birds, and luring all these birds to your aviary, as they say in the rules, I think.
Awesome.
Ladies and Gentlemen is a game where you play... you're playing on a team, teams of two. Each team consists of a lady and a gentleman, a Victorian era lady and a gentleman and each play different games. A gentleman goes to work in the stock market and makes money, buying and selling contracts and things. And then the ladies collect pretty dresses and pretty items like that. It's a very sexist game, but it's kind of plays up that stereotypes.
Right, it leans into it.
Yeah, it definitely leans into it, and it's very fun when I got to play the lady and Candy was my gentleman, and, you know, she would come home from work and be like, and I'm like, could you please buy me this dress? She's like, I only have enough money for the dress, but not the crown, like that sort of thing.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah, so just a fun theme.
Can I mention a couple that I would like to just These are just going to be like rattling off a little list because these are super easy, because these are ones where it drew me in solely because of the intellectual property. Batman, Gotham City Chronicles. It's Batman. I can't say no. The Reckoners. The Reckoners is based off of a book series called The Reckoners by Brandon Sanderson. Brandon Sanderson is far and away my favorite author. And I love the books. The theme of that is you are essentially in a world with superheroes who like woke up one day and had superpowers. It was like just this event that gave people various superpowers. But instead of using superpowers for good, they pretty much became tyrants. And you are part of the group called the Reckoners, where you are fighting the superheroes to try and take them down so that you can like restore order. And I was drawn into that because I read the books. I love the books. I love Brandon Sanderson's books. So that one was like an easy in for me. And there's an expansion coming to Kickstarter, I think next week, that covers books 2 and 3. There's 4 books. So I was really, really drawn into that. And then any game that has the words Lord, Rings, and of the in between them, pretty much draw me in as well.
Rings of the Lord.
Yeah, Rings of the Lord, even that would probably draw me in just to see what it's like. But those are ones that are based on properties that I am deeply invested in one way or another. So they will always at least get a look from me.
Right.
And I could probably, honestly, I could go down my own board games list and probably pick out a reason why the theme of every one of these games drew me in. So I don't want to go like super in depth on all of them. But I feel like I would be missing something if I didn't personally mention Mythic Battles Pantheon, because I love Greek mythology. I think it's a really, really cool, it's just a cool subject in general. And just having a game where you are these gods and you're fighting against each other is just super neat. And of course, all the miniatures. So,
of course, I want to mention Castell, which is the game about making human towers. I mean, that's crazy, and somehow there's a board game about it.
Yeah, I can't believe I missed that one. That's a good one.
Yeah, so that definitely drew me in. And then Spirit Island, I think, is also a really, really, really cool theme.
Yeah, I was going to mention that.
It is the anti-colonialism board game where you play as different spirits protecting your island. And all of the spirits have super cool names. They all have great art. And it's just a really cool theme. And really well executed as well.
Yeah.
For sure. Like one of my favorites in terms of the name is one of them is it's high complexity, so I've never played it, but I know it has to do with like spreading fear, but the Bringer of Dreams and Nightmares is just like such a super cool sounding spirit.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a neat theme. I was going to mention that one as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ocean's Hungry Grasp is great. River Surges in Sunlight. Wonderful.
Yeah.
So I have a question for you two guys. Have you ever bought a board game solely on theme, even though you knew it wasn't going to be good or you didn't know anything about it? You just saw the theme and you're like, I'm buying that. I know Ben has by the look on his face.
Yeah, if you just started a question with, have you ever bought a board game, ... Ben is answering, it's yes.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, the funny thing is, there are games where, what's the best way to say this? There were games where when I bought them, they were like late pledges on Kickstarter, so I had even less time to figure out if I was interested than I would normally have. Mm-hmm. And I would 100% say with no hesitation, Rising Sun is on that list. Rising Sun, it was like, there's actually two. There's two that I can mention without a doubt, 100%, where this is the case. Rising Sun is the first one. Rising Sun is all about Japan, feudal Japan, and the various spirits and Oni that are in Japan, or just some random one that they took from Wikipedia. That's a man in New Zealand put himself on Wikipedia saying he was a Japanese spirit, and they put him in the game because they do no research.
Yeah, bad look for them.
Yeah, but they did send the guy a free game, which is kind of funny, but still. Rising Sun is beautiful. It's a beautiful game. I've always wanted to go to Japan. I've never been to Japan, and I think
it's fantastic. I love it.
Yeah, I think just the art and theme of Rising Sun drew me in, and I think there was like a week left in the late pledge, and I was just like, okay.
Had you played Blood Rage up until that point?
I think I had played Blood Rage, but I don't think that I put together in my mind that it was the same designer slash company, really. Because this was back when I like really just started buying bigger games. I think I bought Scythe, and then like a month later, I backed Rising Sun.
Got it.
And then the other one, and it's going to be super quick, Madara. Madara is a, as we've mentioned in the past, JRPG, Japanese RPG style dungeon crawl game. And it's a cooperative story-based dungeon crawl, but it's got a very anime style to it. And literally, the very last day of late pledges, I was like, looks neat. Bye. And when you look back at it, though, incredible deal. Because this whole game, which is huge, $100, free shipping in the U.S., and on the second time around on the Kickstarter, it went up to $135 for the same thing without free shipping.
Okay.
So they actually lost a good chunk of money on the first game because they offered free shipping because this game is huge. And I got in on the last day of the late pledge, which got me free shipping and the whole game for $100. And looking at the game itself, I mean, it was actually a deal. But those two are the first two that jump to mind when it comes to solely just buying on theme without knowing anything about the game.
Sweet. I can answer this question. And very quickly, the answer is
no.
Exactly. No. Yeah. I don't know. I buy and I sell my board games quite frequently. I try and thin down my collection as much as I can. And I try not to have more than one game that like has the same mechanic as the core of it, unless they like really do it differently. So, you know, for worker placement games, Anachrony has time travel, Tolkien has neat spinning gears, and Dominant Species is totally different. So
yeah.
I don't think I have ever bought a game just based on the theme, because if I did, I probably would have ended up selling it, and then it's just a hassle. So, Patrick, the answer is yes for you, I take it?
Actually, no, it's not. I have definitely given games a look solely on theme.
Oh, definitely.
But I don't think I've ever bought one sight unseen, so to speak.
Ben is looking at us longingly, wondering how we have this self-control.
Yeah, I've come close where I was like, ooh, I think Scoville was one. I'm like, I love hot sauce. I was on a hot sauce kick at the time and a board game kick. So I'm like, oh, let me get this game. But I looked into it first. And then I was like, okay, right, this game looks cool. But no, nothing that comes to mind.
I think if you asked me the question, have you ever bought anything ... in general life, the answer is going to be yes for me at some point. Did you buy this disc without knowing what it does for disc golf? Yeah, the stamp is cool. I mean, pretty much anything. It doesn't matter. I like collecting things. I like buying. I'm a compulsive shopper, and
yeah,
I feel like this is an intervention for me, but I also don't care. So. But yes,
harmless
the answer
question,
for me is yes. All. The answer for you guys is no. And it's how it should be for most people is no. Definite yes from me.
I feel like we should also, very surprisingly, talk about games where the theme turns you off. We didn't talk about doing this in advance, but if we can think of some now.
I mean, I can jump. Yeah, go for it, Ben.
I was going to talk about a game that the theme drew me in, but I know that the intro for this game absolutely just demolished any desire for you to even look at it, Jonah.
And, I know what that is.
And can you guess what it is? I feel like you should, let's just say...
Something Cthulhu related?
No, let's just say it's a Simon game or Kaman game. With the most stupid video you could possibly imagine when it comes to introducing this game.
Oh my god.
The game is literally called Hate. And It's like this ridiculously over-the-top, like grim dark fantasy world where you're like killing other tribes, but you like bring them back to your home territory and you like cook them and eat them for bonuses and stuff. But the video for the Kickstarter for this game was literally just like a mid-90s edge fest
Yeah, if you asked a 13-year-old who just discovered the F word to make you a video about a board game about...
Yeah,
it's very true.
It was a really stupid video, and I'm pretty sure that the theme in general would probably turn you off of this game.
Right.
But I don't know. Things like this, A, don't bother me, and B, I mean, it's more miniatures, so it looked cool. So,
right.
But yeah, and I know for you, Jonah, the other one is Cthulhu. Cthulhu doesn't turn me off, but it turns you off.
Just very disinteresting to me.
I agree with Jonah on that. I think it's just, you know, maybe back in the day when every other game wasn't Cthulhu, I would have been more interested.
Right.
But right now it's Cthulhu and generic fantasy are just like gloss over. I will no interest in looking at them unless I hear something good about it, you know, some other way.
Right. It's funny because generic fantasy, you know, Terra Mystica technically is generic fantasy, but somehow I like didn't notice it the first time I played it.
Right.
I guess because they're different names, because, you know, like Swarmling and Mermaid, but then of course there's basically a hobbit and basically an orc, so.
Yeah, and that also has, you know, years of people loving the game for you to be interested in it.
Right. Yeah.
Honestly, I can't think of a theme that would turn me off. I feel like I would try almost anything. And I don't...
Sorry, go on.
Yeah, I mean, maybe just generic, like, trading-based games, like Catan. Like,
right. Yeah, just farming, generic farming. Trading.
Yeah, maybe, like, the world's most generic themes would turn me off. But, like, if someone took farming and put, like, a spin on it that
like
made it...
Scythe.
Yeah, like Scythe or Scoville, like...
Yeah,
I would be like, okay, let's try it. But like generic is not my thing.
Yeah, I was going to say trading in the Mediterranean because there are just so many board games about, you know, like Concordia is moving around and getting spices and blankets and nonsense like that. And it's just the most, I think it's the number one used theme in board games. And then after that is Cthulhu. And then after that is zombies. And to be honest, I'm not interested in zombie games either.
I agree with you there. Zombies are, and maybe historical warfare type games, just not my thing. I know a lot of people like that, but I'm just not my thing.
Yeah. It's interesting because there are some games with theme that will really draw me in. There are some games with theme that will really push me away. And then there are also games with super pasted on theme where it like doesn't even feel like you're doing anything related to what the theme is. And the best example I can give is one that I mention every time we talk about theme, just because it's so funny to me. Hansa Teutonica.
Yep.
Hansa Teutonica, I think, is a neat game. It is nowhere near my favorite game, but I think it's really cool. And you're just moving cubes around on a board. That's it. And, you know, they have this elaborate backstory about the... Hanseatic League in 14th century Germany and establishing trade outposts. But look, it's just moving cubes around and they had to put a theme on it to make it sellable.
Right.
Yep.
Any others that you can think of, Patrick, besides Cthulhu and zombies? And
no, I think it's just, you know what it is? It's generic themes is really what turns me off. Unless there's something really offensive in some way, which I have not seen a game yet that is like that, then it's just, I need something different. I mean, there's too many games. You need to do something to stand out.
Right. Yeah.
I think the reason for me that the theme isn't necessarily like something that can turn me off is because I feel like even if the theme is like, but they can integrate it into the game in a way where the theme actually does make sense, where you said, Jonah, paste it on, where it's not pasted on, then I feel like I'm cool giving it a shot. Like, I guess the only thing I could think of is, like, Cthulhu Wars and Blood Rage are very similar games. They play almost the same way, where you spend rage or you spend power to do actions on the board. But, like, the addition of spell books in Cthulhu Wars, where each spell book you unlock is like a cultist unlocking the power of your elder god, to me makes it different enough that I own Cthulhu Wars. Blood Rage, is different enough because you can upgrade your clan, you can, you know, you do all these things with, like, monsters from Norse mythology. So I think that that's a little different enough. But in terms of, like, the actual gameplay, they're pretty much the same game.
Mm-hmm.
That about does it for today's episode of Jonah and Ben Play Board Games with Friends. Thank you, Patrick, very much for joining us for the third time now.
Hey, you both are very welcome. Looking forward to playing games again in person someday, maybe even giving you soul back. Who knows?
Oh, yeah, that would be cool.
And Jonah, yeah, Jonah, Patrick, and Ben Play Board Games with Friends.
Yeah, that's what it's yeah, turning right. And thank you, everyone, for listening. And thank you, Louisa, for the excellent music throughout.